Tonight, we are starting the 10th step, and we're going to be connecting it to the portion of the week, which is a portion of Bo, or I'm a Polish Jew, Boy, any way you want to pronounce it. It's written in Hebrew, Beis Aleph. What's very special about this week's portion is the fact that the leaving of Egypt is being read this week. And for everyone to understand and to appreciate that in Judaism, the historical event of leaving Egypt takes a very important part of our lives. The concept of Egypt is constraint, limitations, challenge, conflict, divisiveness, and the story that we live with this week of our people leaving Egypt is really the quest that we all have. We all want to leave our personal Egypt eventually to get to the promised land. What is unique about the 10th step, for me, for a newcomer, is that the 10th step is the first step of the 12 steps, we're getting towards the end, that literally repeats to a certain degree step number 4. So in the 12 step system, you have step number 4. To reach step number 4, to make a searching and a fearless moral inventory. Okay, and we dealt with it then. And then we go through 5 other steps, which are very difficult and real, the real work, real house cleaning. And then we come to step 10 and we go again, and step 10 reads to continue to take personal inventory, and when we are wrong, to promptly admit it. So practicing a certain exercise, doing something internally, and then repeating it, is one of the greatest challenges that we face in life. It's interesting that in this week's portion we also read about the commandment to make the Jewish calendar. And in Hebrew, how do we say the word year? Shana. What does shana mean? So the word shana has a paradoxical meaning. It means repetition. In Hebrew, the word year means to repeat, because people superficially can look at a year and see it simply as a, oh, we're here again. Right? We're using a Jewish calendar. Rosh Hashanah, it was just Rosh Hashanah, the same Rosh Hashanah, the same Yom Kippur. We're going through a cycle and we are repeating the cycle again and again. And the word shana in Hebrew also means to change. Repetition means to do the same thing again. Repetition means the opposite of what change means. And it's beautiful that both of these words are somehow imbued in the word shana. And the truth is, like in all paradoxes, that one comes together with the other. That there are certain movements, there are certain steps in life that the only way we can achieve it, the only way we can achieve a change, is through a repetition. And we all know that. You know, when we start out doing something new, there's always the excitement, there's something, it's new, it's a novelty. And most, if we're not angels, that enthusiasm, that magic of novelty, sooner or later wears off. And the greatest, you know, challenge of maturity is, how do we deal with repetition? Okay, I have done that, I have been there. Am I going to lose my enthusiasm and constantly be moving on to something else? Or do I have the fortitude to stick to the program and to do it and again and again and again? And the repetition ultimately is not simply to be walking around in a circle, but every repetition ultimately does bring change. I just want to share with you 3 simple points regarding repetition connected to the theme of this week's portion. And I'm sure that you guys have your own take on step 10. But I see it that one can literally understand and practice 10 on 3 totally different ways. I want to share with you a couple of illustrations regarding repetition. doing something once and doing it again. When is it harder? To do it the first time or to do it the second time?
Second time.
So the answer will be, it depends on what scenario. Let me give you a simple illustration. You're going on a trip, you're going on vacation, and you shut up your cell phone, right, and you come back home after a month off, and you open up your cell phone and you have, it's maybe 187 messages. And you have to go through all of them just to catch up. So that exercise will be very time consuming and very draining, it's going to be challenging. But when you finally get into the program, when you clean out your message box, from now onward, to go back every day to your message box is a lot simpler, a lot easier than doing it the first time. So one can say that really that step number four is the hard work, because step four and step five and six, you know, we're really working on ourselves. We're doing a real house cleaning. But once we achieve a certain level, then now it's just, we're just maintenance, we're just maintaining where we are. It might be to a certain degree simpler. I think there's a certain truth to that, or not. I'll tell you a nice story that I heard in yeshiva. There was someone giving a class on time management. And they wanted to make an illustration, so the speaker pulled out this big mayonnaise jar that was empty, and he takes out large rocks, and he fills up the jar with rocks, until the jar is filled to the brim. And he turns to the audience and he asks them, "Nu, chevre, is it full?" They say, "Yeah." So he pulls out a bag of gravel, and he pours the gravel into the jar of mayonnaise. And the gravel, you know, there was room for the gravel. Until the gravel, and he bangs the jar for it to fall down to the bottom, and it's filled to the top, and he turns to the audience, and he asks them, "New guys, is it full?" And by now they're getting smarter, they say, "We don't know, perhaps." So he pulls out a bag of sand, and he puts the sand in the jar, and there was room for the sand, until the sand is filled to the top. And again he turns to the crowd, and he asks them, "New guys, is it full? Is there room for anything else?" And they say, "Yeah, there's room for something else." So what does he pull out now?
Water.
And there was room for the water. So after that illustration, he asked the audience, "What's the moral of the story? What are you guys learning from this?" So everyone said, "Well, the moral of the story is that there's always more time. Whenever you think that your day is filled, there's not, I have no time to do anything new, you can always make time for something new." And the speaker said, that's not the moral of the story. He said that in life there are more important things and the less important things and the lesser important things. And we have to have the wisdom to know how to prioritize and to firstly put in the big rocks. Firstly, you deal with the big issues. And only after you dealt with the big issues do you have the luxury to deal with the lesser issues. And so on and so forth. So to a certain degree, one can argue that when it comes to the repetition of the 10th step versus the 4th step, the 4th, the 5th, the 6th, the 7th, the 8th, the 9th, that's the big rock. That's the real hard work. And once we achieve that, so then there's a virtue. Now we're going to go through it again and again and again. Now we're going to work with the smaller things. And then with the smaller things, we once gave an example of a person who had a garment. The garment was very soiled. After the person cleaned out the garment from the real schmutz, then he began to notice that there are smaller stains that he never even noticed before, because the garment was so dirty that those small stains looked beautiful. And after he cleaned out the lesser stains, then he noticed even more refined stains. So there's a certain way of looking at the system, that the beginning is the hardest part, and the point of repeating it again is, now that we dealt with the bigger issues, now we have the luxury, now we have the clarity, now there is virtue to deal with lesser issues. This is, huh?
You look at it in a way, same way, if you come into a dirty, dirty home, and you clean out a dirty home, it's easy because you see the result and you know you have to do it.
I'm going to totally agree with you. Fine. I'm getting this.
But when you get into a clean home,
I'm getting it. I totally agree with you. So I'm saying, at first glance, one can make an argument that when a person had no one worked on oneself for many years, and now you have to deal with your real issues, so initially it's hard, and once you're getting into it, then it might get easier and easier. That is one way of looking at it, and then there's the opposite way of looking at it. And the opposite way of looking at the 10th step, and I think that's very much connected to the moral of the portion, it's like we mentioned before. Try something. When you succeed, you get confidence, you get inspired, you go for it again. You know, success breeds success. But we all have certain areas in our lives that we try to accomplish something, and we fail. And most people can only handle failure up until a certain point. You do it once, I failed. Okay, I'll go for it again. And again I fail. And again. There comes a point that if we're not machines, we break down, we give up. And that's the challenge of any addiction, is that when we try to deal with something, and again, and we are constantly failing, there comes a certain point where a person can say, I give up. Trying again, from this angle or from that angle, is helpless. Let me just make peace with who I am, and this is who I am. And this is really the story of the week. When we were in Egypt and God told Moses, go speak to Paro and get the Jews out of there. And he goes for it and he fails. And he goes for it again and he fails. And this happened for 7 times and he fails. So the fortune begins. God tells Paro, go. God tells Moses, again go to Paro. Every time you repeat a certain activity, with the purpose, with the goal of achieving a certain success, and you fail at it, then doing it again doesn't get easier. Doing it again gets harder and harder. What we all need to know is that when we try, when we focus, when we work on something, even if we failed 1,000 times, there will be a certain point. There will be a certain time that we will succeed. And if we don't believe in that, then it's virtually impossible to tackle the real challenges that we all have in life. You have to have that belief. You know, Hasidim, we have a custom of storytelling. And storytelling is very powerful because the idea, right? We all hear the idea. Go for it again, try for it again. But sometimes when you hear a story, real story, and you see how going for something that is difficult, that you tried once and twice and thrice and failed, and going for it again, and knowing and hearing stories of people that finally succeeded, literally we need that sometimes. We need to see, we need to witness how I might have tried it 100 times and failed. Nevertheless, I will succeed this time. And therefore I'm going to try again. And this is what Moshe Rabbeinu did, and he went through it again and again, and at the end he succeeded and we left Egypt. And here is the story. And it's a beautiful story. The story happened in year 2000. The story happened approximately 12 years ago. The story happened in, throw down the city, in Rockville. That's somewhere in greater Washington. It was a Jewish home for the elderly. And there was a program that the local Jewish high school had with that, if you want to call it the old age home, or if there's a nicer or better word for that.
Convalescence.
Retirement. Oh, there you go. And the high school students used to volunteer a certain amount of time of their summer vacation to do work in that home. And there was a bacher, there was a young man, his name was Mordechai Keller, a real person. And he, very idealistic. He came from a more religious background, and there were a certain percent of religious retired men and women in that home, and they had a certain area designated for, you know, a prayer room. They had a little shul in there, and there were certain people that spoke Yiddish, so he was like a perfect match. And you know, he was very idealistic, and he decided this entire summer he's going to devote himself to me in that home. And this is the story that happened there. Beautiful. Comes to the home. One of the jobs that he undertook was there was a morning minyan, right? You have to have 10 male Jews over 13 years that get together to make a quorum, to make a minyan, to be able to pray the entire prayer, even though everyone can pray whenever they want, wherever they want, on their own, and there's a beauty to that, but there's something about communal prayer. And he used to go around to suggest, to collect, to help the older men make their way to the synagogue, etc. And there was one, there's always this one grumpy old man that was nasty, And whenever he approached him, he got brushed off. And normally, you try once, you try twice, you try again, you give up. This Mordechai was young and dumb, or smart, and he never gave up. And he was always happy and enthusiastic, and he knew that this old man is not going to respond nicely. He was always nasty to him. And he's always nudging him, come on, let's go to shul, let me help you. And he got a brush. And there was one day that this old man was particularly in a bad mood. And he got very irritated at this young 16-year-old boy. And he told him, you want me to come to the synagogue? I want you to come to my room, I want to show you something. Alright, good. So Mordechai walks up to this old man's room and he goes over to the dresser and he says, go to that dresser, open up the top drawer and take out the bag that's over there. And he opens up the top drawer and what's laying over there is a bag, very old bag, and in there is a very old, unused pair of tefillin. And this old man begins to share with this young boy his sad, bitter, tragic life. He was telling him that he's a survivor, that he came from a very large religious Hasidic family in Poland. Before his bar mitzvah, when he was 12 years old, his entire family was rounded up. The only people that survived the first few weeks was his father and himself. Everyone else got killed right out in the beginning. And he describes how life was as a 12-year-old boy in the barracks in a certain camp. He was describing how there were certain people there that came from religious homes that were stubborn, that they were not going to give up any part of their Yiddishkeit. And one of them managed to smuggle not a full pair of tefillin, just the head tefillin, because we have the hand tefillin, and we got the head tefillin, and they managed to have a head pair of tefillin. And how certain men would risk their lives to put it on every morning. Which is an amazing thing. I mean, here you have, you're risking your life, you know you're not even getting the full mitzvah, but you're doing what you could. And this boy is telling you, the old man, he's explaining to Mordechai, I want you to know that my bar mitzvah was coming nearer and nearer. And what really bothered my father was the fact that on my bar mitzvah day, I'm not going to put on a full pair of tefillin. We just got the head tefillin, not good enough. Alright, so what do you do? So this is very dangerous. They discovered that a couple of barracks down, they heard a rumor that there they had a full pair of tefillin. To go at night or early morning, when it wasn't your time to leave your barrack, to go and to ask to get it was risking your life terribly. But this old man is saying, my father told me that he needs to get for me that pair of tefillin, if it's there. And I said, I remember seeing my father walking out of the barrack. And he's walking out, it was a very cold morning, and he disappears, and I'm trembling by the window, dreading the worst. So around 10 minutes, an eternity for me then, goes by, and in the distance I see my father coming back. And I see that in his hands he's clutching, he's holding on to something. So I know that he succeeded. And I'm very anxious and I'm very excited. And my father is coming closer and closer. And he's about to come back into the back. Out of nowhere, he says, a Nazi comes out. He sees a Jew. He saw my father walking outside. And there was no permission to walk outside. Then he didn't ask him anything. He shot him dead. Right in front of me. And he walked away. And I run out of the barrack. I witness my father getting murdered. And I open up his hands. And he tells him, and this is the pair of tefillin that my father was holding on to. So he looks at this young boy and he tells him, you tell me, how can I pray to a God that would allow a 12-year-old boy watch his father getting murdered because he wanted me to have this pair of tefillin? You tell me, how can I make a prayer? What would you tell him? Well, he was very uncomfortable. He's a 16-year-old. He's a volunteer. He definitely meant no harm. He apologized. He said, I'm sorry. And he promised them, I will never bother you again to go pray. And he walks out of the room. And he feels horrible. He made a promise. He says, not a week, less than a week goes by. God always does it. And lo and behold, from the people in that home, in the retirement home, there was a man who had the yahrzeit, which means there was a man that needed to say the Kaddish. They needed to have dominion. You needed to have 10 Jews, and that day that this person needed to have the quorum of 10 Jews, there were 9. With the volunteers, you got 9, you don't have 10. What are you going to do? The 10th guy was an old man. Someone has to say Kaddish. So Mordechai, this young boy, he made a vow ahead, in Yiddish, a vow ahin, a guy has to say Kaddish. He goes in, he knocks on the old man's door. The old man is very upset. He says, what do you want? He says, listen, you have all the right to get upset at me. He says, there is a fellow Jew here that needs to say Kaddish. You're the 10th Jew. We need you in the synagogue. And to his shock, I mean, he was ready for the worst. This time he was prepared. The old man says, fine, for sin? For God, no. But a fellow man needs my help? Count me in. And Mordechai says later, he doesn't know what went into his mind. But for some reason he had the courage to tell him, can I take the pair of tefillin for you? And to his shock, the old man said, okay. So this old man needed to be wheeled in there. So he goes to that cabinet and he pours it in and takes out the pair of tefillin. And he gives it to the elder man and he wheels him down into the synagogue. And the old man says, listen, you got to put me right near the entrance, right near the exit. Because the moment that the prayers are over, I'm out. Don't put me in the front. Fine. Would you like me to help you put on the pair of tefillin? Kid has courage. The guy says, fine. For the first time in his life, the old man put on the pair of tefillin. Now Mordechai was, he was young. He was afraid of some type of outburst. So he silently, he felt, wow, that was amazing. He walked away. He was dealing with the minyan, with the Kaddish. And when the Kaddish was over, when the prayers were over, he knew that the first man out is that old man. He walks over to him, but that old man had no interest to leave. He was sitting there in his wheelchair. He was caressing the straps of the tefillin. And he heard the old man in Yiddish saying, Oi, Tata. Oi means Oi. Tata means father. He says, Oi, father. Oi, father. And he's crying. So he left him alone. See, they came back an hour later. And the old man tells Mordechai, I want you to know that for the first time since my father was murdered, I feel connected to my father. Oi, Tata. When he was finally ready to leave the room, he tells this boy, let me ask you a favor. I want you to come every day and bring me to the shul with my father's tefillin. And for the remaining weeks of that summer, Mordechai was there. He rolled the old man into the room, with a minyan, without a minyan, put on his father's tefillin. He stayed there for a nice amount of time. And all he was saying was, Oi, Tata. Came the day, Mordechai goes into the man's room and the man is not there. And he felt, that's not good. And he was right. He asked the nurse, where is the older man? She says, well, unfortunately, there was a medical challenge last night. He was rushed to the hospital, and he passed away. At the end of that summer, the retirement center, they made a special evening to congratulate, to honor all of those volunteers, young volunteers. And Mordechai won a great prize over there. They gave him an honor. They thanked him. They made a ceremony for him. And when the formal part was over, he's schmoozing with family members, with the people that were there, with their children, with their grandchildren. This woman, whom he never met, walked over to him. And she tells him, Mordechai, you don't know who I am, but I know who you are. So he asked this woman, who are you? She says, I'm that nasty old man's daughter. And I want you to know like this, that when my father was rushed to the hospital, the only thing that he was crying for was for his tefillin. And he says that when he was in the hospital, he made me put on his father's tefillin. And when he passed away wearing his father's tefillin. Bound to his father in heaven. That's what she tells Mordechai. So here you have a young man that attempted to break through to someone and did not succeed. It takes a lot of courage. And he tried again and again. But when there was a breakthrough, it wasn't just any breakthrough. He literally achieved the transformation. You know, the areas in life that we attempt to correct and that become easy, which is wonderful, no one is looking for challenges. Well, it's wonderful But the real growth that all of us could achieve are in those areas that we tried once and again and again and we failed. And that's where you separate, in English you say, you know, the men from the boys, or if I don't know how that works, by the women. Okay, there's a certain, everyone has a breaking point. You can only try X amount of times. So the beauty of step 10 is to tell you that if you tried to make a moral inventory, and we all try to do that, and we all fail, we succeed in certain areas and we fail in others. You know, it's not difficult, it's not easy to look at oneself and to really objectively see who we really are. And again, we're not talking about external behavioral issues. Those are easy to know. And the issue is not the behavior, it's just the, you know, it's just the symptom. It's just the consequence of what needs to be fixed. The real inner working is very difficult. No one likes to look in the mirror and to see something that's not beautiful, or the opposite. And we fail. And if we succeed, it's a half success. And then we go through step 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. And the beauty is that there comes a certain point where we have the courage to say, you know what? In those parts where I failed, step number 10, I'm going to go for it again. And again, and again, and again. And if I'm going to fail today, I'm never going to give up tomorrow. So, like Ephraim was saying, that even though that externally one could make the argument that step number 10, that the first time we're going through the 12 steps, first time a person is really looking at themselves with the purpose of transforming oneself and really tackling the real challenges in life. Well, to a certain degree, the first time you do it is the hardest time, and there's a lot of messages that have to be attended to, and once we reach a certain higher level, it's just maintenance. Yes and no. And more no than yes. Because step number 10 doesn't mean repeating the same thing again. It means attempting to fix those things in our lives that we tried so many times before we gave up. And of course we gave up. There's only a certain amount of times that we can try to go for something and to fail. How many times can you fail? So you make peace with certain things. And certain things cannot be made peace with. There are certain areas in our lives that we need to fix. We want to get better, we got to fix it. Now, sometimes you need a break. Fine. So that's why step number 10 doesn't come after step number 4. You got a lot of steps in between. You don't get a real break, but you shift the focus. But you shift the focus and you come back. And to a certain degree, this is the story of the portion, and it's beautiful, it's amazing that the portion that records our people's leaving Egypt. You know, everyone asks, you read the Chumash, why didn't we put the 10 plagues in one portion? And then the leaving of the Egypt should have been the beginning of this week's portion. But it doesn't work that way. We got 7 of the plagues last week. And this week we might go to the plagues. What's the name of the portion? Boy, what does boy mean? Come to whom? Come with me to Paro. Not leave Egypt. One would say, come on, this portion is the most important portion of the whole Torah. The theme is the Jewish people were leaving Egypt. You know, we mentioned the Egypt in the morning, we mentioned Egypt at night, our leaving Egypt, the Exodus. So why don't we give some, you know, honor to the event and title, coin the parsha with the name of the leaving of the Egypt, because the only way you leave Egypt is by going back to Paro and going back to Paro and going back, and I failed and again go to Paro and again do it and again go to Paro. And it's beautiful that in Hebrew, boy is a very simple word. It means come. And how do you spell boy? Beis Aleph. Ah. Beis Aleph. Aleph, Beis Aleph. Why does Beis Aleph go deeper? Normally we go from A to B to C, going outwards, going inwards, going deeper, going backwards. Going backwards means going deep. So if we fail at something, we failed at it because we didn't go deep enough. Now, one of the ways is one of the Jewish holidays, to a certain degree, is the holiday called Lag BaOmer. Lag BaOmer marks, amongst other things, the day of the passing of the author of the Zohar, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And one of the Jewish customs is to celebrate that holiday by playing around with a bow and arrow. With a bow and an arrow. Oh, so what's the bow and arrow? So there are many reasons for it, but one of the beautiful reasons is when you want to shoot an arrow, and you're using a bow as your tool to get the arrow far. So look at the irony. The farther you want the arrow to go, the more you have to pull it in. So if you have to achieve something out there means in my behavior, which is out there. In here is my emotional, is my psychological, is my spiritual self, that's in here. Out there is what I think, what I talk, what I do, and I'm trying to out there fix something. You want to fix something out there, then you got to work on what's in here. And if you're not succeeding, if the arrow is not hitting where you want the arrow to hit, the solution is, pull it back deeper. Beis Aleph. And when you want to pull something back deeper, you can never get it right the first time. It's almost very hungry. Days of hunger. The Russians, and my mother has a joke. So you're hungry. So finally, when they ate the fifth slice of bread, they finally began to feel a little bit satisfied. So the brother tells his brother, you ate five slices of bread. Why couldn't you eat the fifth slice first? And there would have been another four slices left. And the answer is, Yechacham, the reason why the fifth slice made you satisfied is because you ate for one, two, three, five times. The fifth time you got satisfied. Yeah, so there's a certain dynamic of life, which is that if you want to really achieve success, you got to go for it again and again and again. When it came to leaving Egypt, it's funny, what was the number that did it? How many plagues were there?
10.
Another 10 steps. What step are we up to? The 10. Something about 10. 10 is like a full cycle. Something got to do it, the whole cycle, got to do the whole spiel. And it doesn't end there. Because we all know, there's success on one level, and then there's success on a deeper level, and then there's success on even a deeper level. And it's ad infinitum, it's forever. There's something else about step number 10. There's another way of looking at it. As in our lives, like we began speaking before, any novelty brings excitement. Excitement, passion is power. When we are excited, when we are passionate about something, no one can beat you. All of our challenges, especially in behavior, all stem from the fact that we are not passionate about our conviction. We know that this is the way I should be, but we don't have that, passion. We're not burning about it. We're not excited about it. God made the world in such a way that excitement normally comes in the beginning of things. And most of us need excitement as our gasoline to achieve something. Which is why most people, when they initiate, when they start out in any endeavor, they take an army, they're advancing, and they're conquering, and they're moving. Shkoyach, very nice. And now what? Now they gotta stay, they gotta hold their ground. Oh, that's infinitely harder. Maintenance is a lot harder. Going up, achieving, I was never here before, that's wonderful. Now I was here already. It's the hardest thing in the world. So there has to be a secret. So how do we keep our enthusiasm and passion when we are doing something again and again and again? What's the answer? If we need passion, if we need excitement, if by nature people are excited, first time, we're humans, you do it once, you do it three times, four times, whatever your magical number is, there's a certain point where people feel, I did that, done there, been there. I'll do it again if it's important, but you don't have excitement.
You don't even learn anything. Every day we begin these things when we're about right there.
But how do we get that passion? How do we get that excitement? We're doing it.
Go back to the passion.
Huh?
Go back.
Once you think you know it all, you kind of see it.
Go back to the passion. What you meant?
It comes from the soul.
But how do you get to your soul? So let's acknowledge that when we learn the secret of tapping into passion, excitement, then we are connected to a power that can literally propel us to change those areas in our lives that are the most challenging to change. So how do you get that passion? How do you get excited?
When you're not selfish,
you get excited. Again and again and again, doing the same thing again and again and again. Rice and potatoes and again the same thing.
Yes,
yes, yes, Adam.
Why is it the same thing?
But how do you love what you do if you don't love what you do?
Well, you don't know what to do.
So there are certain areas in my life that I don't love. Actually, I would have loved to be doing the opposite. That's the challenge. And we all have that. God gave us 613 mitzvahs. God made a system that for sure every Jew will have that at least one mitzvah that we hate, that we can't take. Why did God make that up? Oh, so one sec. So one approach is, listen, there are certain areas in where I'm not excited, but there are other areas that I am excited about. Let me focus on those areas where there is excitement, and then the light of the excitement will spill over. That's one approach. That's not the approach that we're talking about in the 12 steps. In other words, the general idea, Hasidim always uses this example, you know, that the Baal Shem Tov, the master, the founder of the Hasidic movement, he loved light. And he always emphasized how, generally, if you want to deal with darkness, how do you deal with darkness? How do you dispel darkness? With light. You know, his students once told him, he said, I want to give a lecture. So he tells the students, you want to give a lecture? Let's go to that room. So he says, Rebbe, the room is dark. He says, no worries, it's dark. Take sticks and beat the darkness away. Famous story, and the Rebbe said it made no sense, but the Rebbe says, Hasidim did it. They began beating the darkness, and the darkness was there. Throw rocks at the darkness, tried it. At the end, he says, light a candle. When he lit the candle, it became light. And what he was trying to tell them is that normally, if you want to fight with darkness, don't fight with the darkness. Make a light, and the light, by nature, will dispel darkness. And that is a general truth, but that's not the truth that will work when it comes to the 12 steps, and that's not the truth that we're dealing about in this week's portion. In other words, when we left Egypt, you know how we left Egypt? By dealing with darkness. What did God command Moses to do? To go and to talk to Paro, and to talk to Paro. God wanted Paro to agree for us to leave Egypt. If God wanted us to leave Egypt, we didn't need a single plague. God could have said to the Jewish people, just walk, leave. And he could have stopped the Egyptians from coming after us. So the whole episode here is not about us leaving Egypt. It's God wanting Egypt itself to be transformed. And this is what we're speaking about. We're speaking about the power of not, I'm going to focus on the positive, which is very important, and automatically the negative will go away. No, we're speaking about something much deeper. We're going to deal with the negative, we're going to talk with it, we're going to negotiate with it, and we're going to win it over. We're going to transform it. And that's very challenging. So again, when you succeed, I'm a higher, you're excited. But when you do it, and you fail. And then you do it, and you fail. And then you do it, and you fail. And in that area in my life, my darker side is simply winning. Alright, but there are other parts of my life that I'm good at. So focus there. I'm doing that. Still not helping. So I'm getting better at that. I'm learning more Torah. I'm doing more tzedakah. I'm being a nicer person. But in that area, I'm failing. And I have credit. The more good I do, the more credit I have. And we have to change that. So we need to have excitement. You have to have passion. How do you get that passion? When you're dealing with something negative. So this will be continued, God willing, next week. Yes. Yes.
You
like your computer? Yeah, yeah.
When you want to set what's great about it, there is a search that brings to you everything that's great about the situation. If you are in darkness, it may be so like, oh,
But person is already an adult person who is attempting to change one area in their life, and they're failing. And they tried again, and they failed. And again, and they failed. And again, and they failed. Make a moral inventory. And okay, I know my faults. And now what? Fix it. I can't.
I truly believe that when people are great about it, they search you everything that's great about
them. Okay, so to be continued. We're going to be continued. Like I said, the story is like this. Again, we are greatly honored. First of all, again, to thank the Tuesday night class. We are here every single Tuesday night. I got shukriyah for you guys for coming every week and for making space tonight of ending our class a bit earlier in order for us to have the great opportunity to share our Tuesday night evening with a great rabbi and doctor who is here with us. So we have over here a man. You'll see we're learning in Kabbalah that we have the right side and the left side, right? The light side and the dark side, the Chesed and Gevurah. Rabbi Label Wolf's head is tilted to the right. It's because he's wise and kind. Look at that, figure that out. So he has on his paper many titles, but for Hasidim I can introduce him, that we have a great wise and kind rabbi who lives in Melbourne, Australia, who's the Dean of Spirit Grow, and he is here with us tonight. He's going to give a lecture which is going to put forth some ideas from practical Kabbalah, from positive psychology, and we're going to explore together the idea of Kavana, mindfulness, and he's going to give us tremendous tips in training us for us to have a more conscious living and for us to be able to make more effective decisions. Rabbi Wolf travels the world over, and it is our great honor and privilege to have him here with us tonight, Rabbi Wolf.